It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you and me. Have to teach the children about living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome. This is Deanna Spingola, and this is Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, October 27th, 2014. This radio program does not have any corporate sponsors. Therefore, we are free to discuss controversial topics that are, well, impolitically correct, and those you might not hear about on other programs. My website is spingola.com, where you will find information about my three books, The Ruling Elite series, as well as a timeline of book 2 and 3. Please also visit the website of a friend and listener who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. All of the more recent audio files of my programs are at that site. Those include the RBN audio files, the audio files from the American Free Press, and, the ones that we produce right here. My Twitter account is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. If you have questions during the program, please feel free to call 646-787-1915. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatango.com. Please remember, I do not access my regular email address during the program, particularly since my modem crashed a couple of days ago. So I'm just sort of offline on my main computer. My guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the American Nationalist Association and the American Nationalist Network. The website is ANA-ANN.com. Rodney, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Deanna. I'm a bit hoarse this morning. I've been fighting off a lung infection, and it's just given me all sorts of grief.
Oh, so you need to take elderberry syrup.
If I sound, well, I'm going to write that down. If I sound a little hoarse or strange, or if I mute my mic, I'll be right back because I don't want to be hacking on the air.
Sure.
But
if you whinny, well, we know that you really have become a horse.
Yeah. Well, I'll just blame my dog, but
okay.
No, I don't have that barking dog anymore. But the notorious dog used to bark during some of my other appearances on the show. But I appreciate that you haven't been on your show in a while. I've been busy, and I guess I can take a little bit of time and just talk a little bit about what ANA's been up to and what I've been up to. By the way, I've gotten a lot of emails, where is the WV Foundation site, my revisionist history site? It will be back up the first week of November. It's undergoing some renovations. We changed the host so we can actually have some more audio and visual. We have some more oral history to upload. But with the prior host, they had some limitations on, space, and we were getting pretty close to that with some of the audio files and some of the video files. So we made some changes, and the webmaster said, let's cut some of this stuff, remove some stuff and make some, more room. And plus we had some people that were submitting things to it. So he's been working on it, and, it's between doing the work on our ANA site, which, has new content almost daily. It's a lot of work, for a volunteer.
Sure.
So that will be back. We do have some additional writers that are writing over there. There's going to be some slight changes to it. We have a couple of publishing projects in the works as well, which will be announced. So WV Foundations will be back. But as you know, ANA and ANN has been my primary focus. I've become a regular contributor to Press TV on current affairs and even some of the U.S. Domestic affairs as well. In fact, I just did an interview yesterday on the Ukrainian elections, and Press TV asked me to provide commentary during their rolling coverage on the U.S. elections, election night. So I'll be on there live throughout the evening providing commentary on the midterm elections on Press TV throughout throughout the evening, and I think it's a good opportunity for people, political dissidents, people in the wilderness such as ourselves, to get exposure, and our people here in the United States who will access these alternative media channels will see that we're not the cranks that the mainstream Jewish-controlled media makes us out to be. And this was our effort and our way of bypassing that, foul news, Fox News and CNN and all that, who, when they do decide to bring us on, they're very selective as to who they bring on from the truth movement and from the nationalist movement. And when they do, they preface before they even bring them on the air, well, this is a hater and a completely discredited person. So no matter what the person says, they can be very eloquent. But the people have already been programmed to disregard what they say, and I'm going to give an example. David Duke was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer a few years ago, and Wolf Blitzer gave an introduction that just completely trashed Dr. Duke, and Dr. Duke had to spend half the time of his interview debunking the introduction itself. And so at ANA, we made the decision to cultivate relationships with larger, international media that broadcasts into the United States to bypass mainstream American Jewish media. And that way we can be good chess masters and to use events, whether they're events in the United States or world events, establish ourselves that we can present a credible political alternative to this current one that is destroying our culture, destroying our society. And so I'm on there, at least once a week, sometimes two to three times a week. And then with that, I'm also a contributor to the FARS news agency. That's basically I write articles about twice a month. And those are on our website at ana-ann.com. There's a there's a Press TV video bank of all of our Press TV appearances, and there's a link because some of these are audio interviews that I give to their webzine. And then the FARS news agency, there's a section there on our website, and those are the articles where I write basically on policies and policy alternatives, and I have another article in development. So we've been able to really branch out internationally as well. Of course, we made a lot of partnerships and relations throughout the United States as well. We're doing a lot of collaborative efforts with the American Freedom Party, and Bill Johnson's the chairman there. And we're trying to develop kind of a big tent coalition where we, like-minded peoples, we may not agree 100%, but we understand that things are in bad shape for our people specifically. And so we made the people we work with, we decided to, we want to win first, and we can quibble later about the details, but it's important that we win first and present our people with a viable, credible political alternative and bring in, and this is what I want to talk about today, Deanna, is, the nationalist movement has been rather ugly for our people. It's not presented a credible alternative. And by the way, the news site Daily Ken, we partnered with him, and he's actually our news director and runs our news show on Wednesdays at ANN. And he is more of probably a paleo conservative, But he's right on the issues of multiculturalism. He's right on the issues of everybody having a right of self-determination, regardless of who and what they are. Everybody has a right to determine, who they should associate with and who they shouldn't associate with. And everybody, Marcus Garvey, was famous for wanting self-determination for his people, and we support that. And he has an outstanding news site called thedailykin.com, and so we partnered with him, and he runs now our news show on Wednesday. He's also a board member over at the American Freedom Party as well. But getting back to the main focus of what I wanted to talk about today is I recently had, as you know, I talked to you that day. I interviewed Arthur Kemp over in England.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fascinating interview. He's going to come back on the show, on my show. My shows are on Fridays, and you know that because you've been on my show.
Sure.
And I want to pitch you to come back on sometime in November or December. But it was a great interview, and a lot of people make the mistake. Our people are easily misdirected on issues, and that's on purpose by what I consider the single party with two wings, the Democrats and the Republicans. Both do an outstanding job of getting our people to vote against their interests. And he has a book called Nova Europa. And Arthur Kemp has gotten some grief in the nationalist circles because he was born in Rhodesia. And then he lived in South Africa, and those are two countries, as you know, has seen some brutal and outright extermination of white people by Mugabe, who took over after the international community forced multiculturalism on Rhodesia, and then subsequently South Africa. The same thing has happened. And while in South Africa, Arthur Kemp argued against apartheid in much the same way that I argue against supremacy in the nationalist movement. Supremacy is a failed concept. It's ugly, it's immoral, and it leads to the same types of multiculturalism that we have in the United States today. It just doesn't work. What Arthur Kemp advocated was self-determination and the right for every group and every person to their own nations and their own culture, much like National Socialist Germany. It was National Socialist Germany's, we've talked about it on your show. They were an ethnostate, but they weren't haters. They had great relations with the and it was admired greatly in the Arab world. They had great relations in Latin America. Why? Because people admire a person or people that has self-respect for their own culture. And I dare say the reason why I think Americans are on the decline and a lot of nations have lost a lot of respect is that we don't respect ourselves. I have conversations with Hispanics. And they will ask me, because they know my position on this issue, so they don't talk, they know that I feel quite the opposite. They say, why is it a lot of, white European Americans don't stand up for themselves and stand up for their culture and their history? And, why, what is happening? And they said, because if you don't, people will just roll over you. And I said, well, you're going to have to ask the public school teachers, and you're going to have to ask the politicians, and you're going to have to ask the Jews. And I always direct them to the Jews.
What do they say? How do they respond?
Well, this is interesting because we'll get into this today. The Hispanics are some of the most anti-Semitic, what we would call anti-Semitic immigrants, and the Jews are concerned about that. And this came up in a debate I had. I don't know if you're aware of this. I debated a Orthodox Jewish rabbi about 2.5 weeks ago. It was broadcast on another network, radio network, but we simulcasted at ANN. And you can go to our website and scroll down on the right bottom right hand side on our radio, and you'll find it, Rodney Martin, Luke Ford. Now there's two entries. You want the most current one because there was technical issues Because we were feeding off of another network, and there were some technical issues. So the very next day, our engineers actually cleaned it up and took care of the breaks when there was drops. And so you want the most current one. There was no content edited out. We just, when there was dead air and reconnection, we just put that together. But during the and that debate was very revealing, because and the reason why, Deanna, that debate came together. You may not be aware, because I know you don't follow the the drama quest and the what I call the battle. Even though you've been the recipient of it, as I have been, what I call the battle of the blogs and the podcast pissing contest. Pardon the language, but there is this some sort of clown car type of drama fest going on in the what we call the white nationalist movement. And it's important to note that ANA stands apart from what is called the white nationalist movement, because we are not actively looking to be a part of that, nor to necessarily recruit from the blogs of such as Storm Drain, also known as Stormfront, and the Daily Stoner, also known as Daily Stormer. We don't go for that, and I'm going to explain our reasons for that. There's a whole lot of reasons.
And yet they do seem to have some good stuff on once in a while. But you're right. I mean, there's just some things that that are very hateful, and so you just kind of wonder.
Well, that's problematic, and I'll explain to that. That's one of the reasons for the topic. That I asked the we talk about the the topic today. There is this battle that had blown up between this what I call the hardcore wing of white nationalism and the intellectual wing. And my position was, while they're battling it out, they're both wrong. And I'll explain that. But I was having an issue a couple of weeks before that battle broke up. But, people missed the battle I had. And, of course, instead of fighting it out over blogs, which I find, repulsive, I actually engaged in a real-life debate with this Jewish blogger over whether, and the topic of that debate was, are Jews good for Western civilization? And to give you some background, what had happened was we had a conference scheduled back in September, and one of the speakers is going to be Dr. Tom Sunick, a friend of yours,
right,
mine, on the show,
right.
And he was making a speaking tour throughout Southern California, and so we asked him if he'd like to speak at our conference. And of course, because the AFP and ANA, are basically, partnering a lot of various projects and stuff, people assume that speaking tour was our event as well. Well, about a week and a half, 2 weeks before he was scheduled to speak at our conference, we see my email box. I was traveling at the time, loaded up saying, "What is this? What is this?" Well, one of his speaking tours events, it was either the day before or the day after, I can't remember, it was announced that he would be speaking at a Shabbat synagogue and education center to foster, groundbreaking new communication and networking between rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, and Zionists, who don't always agree with each other, those two don't, and white Christian nationalists. And people were outraged. They said, "What are you guys doing? What is going on here?" And I said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 everybody, hold the phones. This isn't our event. He's just a speaker at our conference. But I don't like this any more than you do." And, of course, our board members didn't like it. Some of our members didn't like it. And even people that were going to some of his other events didn't like it. They said, is this a debate? Is it some sort of, what's going on? And, well, sure, it turned out that's not what it turned out to be. It turned out to be that, they were talking about, let's unite, Jews and white nationalists, Christian nationalists, and let's fight Islam. And in my mind, this is what has destroyed our movement in Europe, where you've had these what started out to be rather decent organizations, nationalist organizations, and then they get into bed with the Jews and carry out the Jewish agenda, and they become co-opted. And my question is, when I see all these people banging their shoe Khrushchev style on the table saying Muslim, 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 why don't they have banging the other shoe saying Jew, Jew, Jew? Because the Jewish immigration into Western lands has been far more corrosive. If you look at pornography, homosexual agenda, Hollywood. I mean, you know, we need to hold that issue up as well, and they don't. So I objected to it, as our board did, and we ended up canceling our conference because we said we cannot be associated with this. And we put out a strong statement saying we do not agree with seeking any sort of common ground with Jews and carrying out their agenda. That's what's happened to so many good organizations in Europe. You know, the British National Party made the mistake of doing that, and they now have, you know, they kicked out Nick Griffin. They don't have any seats in the European Parliament, and they're in trouble. I mean, you even have some British national parties in England that proudly put the Star of David, you know, over Celtic, you replaced Celtic crosses and put the Star of David on their flag. So we didn't want to see that happen. We didn't want to see that start to happen here in the United States. And so we opposed it. And as a result, I was asked by a broadcaster who broadcasts online and also broadcast FM out of Santa Barbara, has an FM station out of Santa Barbara, if I would debate this Orthodox Jewish blogger who shared the stage with Tom Sunnick. And they basically talked, you know, Tom would talk, the blog, Mr. Ford would talk. And not only did they talk at the synagogue, but they then went to at least one other venue and they kind of tag teamed. And so here you had Tom and this Jewish blogger speaking at the synagogue, and then the next day they went and spoke someplace else, and it was almost like, here we are, kumbaya, the Jews and the, you know, white nationalist intellectuals, and they're linking arms, and they're all going to go along to get along, and they're going to unite against the Muslim invasion. They're at the gates of Vienna, and we need to unite with the Jews.
Wow, that's
and, you
so
know,
surprising to me.
Yeah, and I just didn't. I thought that was a horrible precedent, and so the. Because I was vocally against it, I was asked by it was Robert Stark, by the way, who moderated the debate, said, why don't you debate your position? And I said, well, I have no problem debating Jews and advocating our position and why it's bad and why Jews are bad for Western civilization. But I am strongly against their uniting and working with them, because you can't work with them.
No, of course not.
So anyway, the debate was a very good debate, and in the end, the Jewish blogger, Orthodox Jewish blogger, and interestingly, he was a convert. He actually was an Australian Gentile convert to Orthodox Judaism, and his positions were very, very superficial, and he could not refute any of the facts, because I went back to in history saying every time the Jews have been allowed to, you know, be our house guests, they've not been good house guests, and they've gone right to work trying to rewire the nations and societies that they live in, and it has not worked out well.
Sure.
And so anyway, that's kind of how that worked out. People can listen to that debate, and that kind of really got me to thinking that, you know, we're in desperate trouble. I look at the state of affairs politically. People are still voting Republican. The Republicans are going to probably win the midterms. They're going to capture the Senate, and they're going to do this by default because people still have a perception that the Republicans are the party of white people, and they think that they don't have any other option. The way the American political system is designed to specifically prevent change. So I had this interview with Arthur Kemp, and in his book Nova Europa, he has, you know, his positions are very, very similar to mine. I read the book; it's a masterful book, and he's talking. The statistics are very, very revealing, and as you know, Deanna, I like facts and figures and statistics because they don't lie.
Sure.
And where we're at in this country, we're at the point of no return. People are harping on immigration, build a Berlin Wall. And what I want to tell your guests right now is we can go down and mobilize the military. We can build a Berlin Wall type of fence tomorrow. And we can halt all legal and illegal immigration, bring it to zero. And demographically, it's too late. We will still, the trends now are in place where we are still going to be, you know, white, you know, European, Anglo-Saxon persons are still going to be displaced. And this is a position I'd written about and had talked about, and people said, we just stop immigration, legal and illegal. And I had told people that it was too late, that, you know, the toothpaste is out of the tube. Well, the statistics in Arthur Kemp's book proves this. The census figures prove this. And so it doesn't matter. We can close. I'm not advocating that just go ahead and let them come. But what I'm saying is the discussion needs to go not only in terms of closing down immigration, but the discussion needs to go is we just can't have a path to citizenship for illegal aliens. Arthur Kemp used the word repatriation, and of course that means deportation in the United States. We actually, if we want to keep all of the United States, then we better start removing those persons that are here illegally, and we better address the issue that if an illegal comes over here and has a child, we automatically confer citizenship, because no other country in the world does that but us.
Of course not. And all those children that they sent north, what was it, 2 or 3 months ago, they have all come in to the country. And you mentioned building a wall. Well, how are we to determine if that wall is to keep us in or keep other people out? I think it works both ways.
Well, sure. And so, you know, and walls, you know, Germany didn't have to build walls. No state has had to build walls with the exception of Hadrian's Wall. And Hadrian's Wall was we know what Hadrian's Wall. And then the Chinese. If you are an effective nation and demonstrate that you mean business, you're going to keep – you don't have to keep your citizens in, and the unsavory elements are going to stay out. They're not going to want to go there because they know, first of all, there's not going to be any jobs there because you can punish those that hire illegal aliens like we're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And walls are not necessarily an effective tool, but we could do it. What I'm telling people is you can do that. And the problem is demographically we've already crossed the Rubicon because the immigrants that are here, the aliens that are here, produce an average of 5 children and our people produce maybe 1. And then, of course, we have the miscegenation issue, which is a touchy issue, but still it's an issue. It's an issue. So we are being displaced, and it's an issue that people will laugh at. Some people call it genocide. There's certainly a cultural genocide. Jews have engaged in cultural genocide. They did so in Weimar Germany till they got kicked out. They ran over here to the United States. And the thing is that I've talked about the Weimar Jews on your show before, Deanna.
Mm-hmm.
And they learned something in Weimar when they came over to the United States. They did something differently. They quietly, they got jobs in Hollywood. They got jobs in New York, and they took a little more time. What they learned in Weimar was they moved too quick, which they did. They did it very quickly, and mm-hmm. they learned that shocked the system, and it created blowback. So in the United States, if you go back and, as I've talked about this book before, and it's called The Jewish Threat, Anti-Semitic Politics of the U.S. Army, and Army Intelligence, U.S. Army Intelligence, for years warned about the Jewish problem. And this book is a gold mine. It's a cat box that is full of diamonds. It's written by Joseph Benderesky, but it's full of declassified Army Intelligence documents where they're talking about the chicanery of these Jews that had come over as far back as World War I, and then the influx of Jews coming in from Germany. But what they learned was they moved too quickly in Weimar, and it created blowback. So when they came over in the 30s up until 1940 and in mid-41, they moved a lot slower and much more methodical and infiltrating the mechanisms of institutions And they just didn't take over, the basic institutions. They took over local institutions as well, and they took their time. And they also adapted to events. They didn't push their agenda anyway. They understood, well, wait a minute, now is not the right time. They understood the Red Scare during the so-called Red Scare during the 50s, and they waited and waited. They did this so-called salami slicer type effect, and then during the chaos of the 60s is when they sprung this. They sprung their big, their big agenda items. Mm-hmm. And if you look, what was the period of time when they really sprung the big events? 1964 to 1968, early 1969. That's when the big social, the big rewiring of American society took place. Was between 1964 and early to mid 1969, but all of the groundwork had been taking place via the salami slicer effect from the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
You can also pin it via court decisions, various administrative acts. It had all taken place, and we mounted no opposition at all. I mean, if you think about it, you have National Guard troops integrating schools. And, what people miss in history, Deanna, is blacks were concerned about integrating schools. They were concerned about losing their identity and losing their culture. They weren't for sure about it, about how this would all turn out. The Great Society programs of these 1964, 1965 has been horrendous. The Jewish agenda has destroyed. It's destroyed the traditional white family, but it has been horrific. It has genocided the traditional black culture, the traditional black family. It has destroyed them.
Oh, totally, completely. Especially with the introduction of drugs into the ghettos, and that was certainly deliberate. But there's something else too that plays into all of this, is the destruction of the currency in other countries. And the destruction of wealthy infrastructure in places in the Middle East. I mean, a lot of the Muslims that we now have in this country have escaped what has become nothing but a bunch of rubble and disease in order to obtain something better. And of course, the peso totally falling in 1994 or somewhere thereabouts. That provoked a lot of the Mexicans to come north in order to support their families. And so this is something, when you look at what the network, the apparatus of the unified, united Jewish efforts are, there you have the U.S. military, which is the enforcement arm their enforcement arm. They have the U.S. military destroying countries all over the world. And well, for instance, look at all of the Vietnamese people that came here after the Vietnam War. They would never have left their country had the U.S. military not gone in and destroyed it. And so they're playing both sides. They are forcing people to relocate, and then they're causing a problem, cultural problems here in this country by saying, oh, look, these horrible people are coming in, and what are you going to do about it? This is so they're playing both ends against the middle here.
Well, sure, and this has to go with the Jewish cabal using the United States as mercenaries to go around the world, securing and exploiting resources.
Sure.
And, this is an interesting study in point is the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Now, Iran, in 1953 with the election of Mossadegh, you had Mossadegh says, no more. Iran had no control over its own natural resources under the Shah.
Right.
And what people don't understand is Mossadegh went to the Shah and tried to get him to be more nationalistic and said, even though Mossadegh was a leftist,
mm-hmm.
I don't accept the point that he was a communist. He was definitely a socialist, I don't
nationalist.
Accept that.
He was nationalist, too.
Yeah. But he went to the Shah, and people forget this. He went to the Shah. He had no intentions of taking the Shah off the throne. But he asked the Shah to stand up and renegotiate the contracts with Aramco and allow some of those funds, get more money to fund basic needs for the country. Now, interestingly, eventually the Shah did see the light and was able to do that, but too little, too late.
Right.
You know. What's happened is you have Kermit Roosevelt and the British intelligence and the CIA goes in, takes out a democratically elected prime minister, and puts the Shah in as an absolute totalitarian monarch, creates the Savik, the most brutal secret police, and represses Iranians. And they remember this, and they basically engage in cultural genocide. What the CIA and the British did in Iran in 1953 is exactly what the British and the United States did to Germany in 1945. They engaged in cultural genocide.
Right.
And they brought in Western decadence into a country that it was foreign to. And what the difference between Iran and Germany is Iran said no. People met in the back, and they just said no. And of course, the difference too is they didn't have all these occupation troops in Iran to basically force them to accept that decadence. And so, the 1979 revolution under Khomeini was a confederation of leftists and even right people on the right and even the Islamic all came together, and it was basically a continuation and blowback from 1953. And that was the first successful effort of saying no to the Jewish, international New World Order, and they kicked them all out. And now you have Iran controlling their own destiny, controlling their own natural resources. And what the sanctions are really about against Iran, it's not about the hostages, the 444 days of the American embassy hostages.
Right.
It has nothing to do with that. Remember, we didn't have diplomatic relations with Vietnam for years and years and years because of this or that, and then we finally established diplomatic relations when it became clear that Vietnam said, we'll let you come in and do unfettered business in Vietnam.
Sure. As soon as they accepted the World Trade Organization, then they were okay. Then it was okay the U.S. government lifted the sanctions, but they were sanctioned from the end of the war up until 1994, I believe.
Yeah. If Iran tomorrow said, we'd be happy to have ExxonMobil come in and take control of our, and take care of our oil fields, the sanctions would be gone.
Sure.
And they would even let them have the nuclear program if they were to do that. This is what it's about. Iran is rich in oil and natural gas, and they would displace the Saudis. And this is what this is about. This is about the U.S., which is still a big bully and a puppet behind Jewish banking cabal and this power elite that you've written about in three books, Deanna, controlling world events by economic or military terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it to Russia as well. Russia is rich in natural resources, and what they try to do is they will prevent a country from bringing those natural resources to market. Now, it's not working. This is what's interesting. And I'm digressing a little bit before I get back on topic, but it's not working because you have these countries now, such as Iran and Russia and India and China. Now, India and China are not on the hit list, the United States sanctioned hit list, but they're major economic players. Those four countries just ignore the United States and they trade among themselves. And so it renders the United States sanctions almost irrelevant. And it also it threatens that economic terrorism that the United States engages in. The United States is much like the old Byzantine Empire in the final days. While it may be rich in terms of creature comforts and material possessions, it's cracking around the edges. It can't, it just cannot. It's just, we've seen what happened in 2008. and had not printed artificial money and engaged in Jewish chicanery to prop up not the banks per se, but the insurance companies, the guarantors of those banks, we would have had a depression that would have made Weimar look wealthy. Mm-hmm. And that's why, I mean, I was just very disappointed that the House and Senate went back after they'd voted no on the bailout, when they got a bunch of public pressure, then that in the middle of the night on a Sunday, they went ahead and voted to do it anyway, because that's what we needed to wake people up. And this is where I'm going now, talking about creating an effective opposition and an effective nationalism for our people.
We do have a caller. Let's give your voice just a few minutes rest. Let's go ahead and take the caller. I have another caller, but I believe he's just coming in just to listen to the program. So let's 727. Okay, 727. Did you have a question? 727, did you have a question or a comment, or are you just listening? Okay, I guess that's enough of a rest, Rodney.
Okay. Well, let me give you one more. Let me give you some statistics here. Let's give an idea of what's happening to the country. Now, California, by the way, there was an interesting article on it was about 2 weeks ago, and it talked about the last two censuses. And it said, about 32% of persons between the prior census and the last census changed their racial designation. And a majority of those were Hispanic, that changed their prior designation from Hispanic to white.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I'll send you the article. I'll send you the article. And so that means...
No, well, okay, so they changed in between the time that they were taken, for instance, of course, the last census made public was 1940. So they were just looking at the race designation and comparing the exact names, or was it just an overall change comparison?
I'm trying to see by the article here. I think I might have it out at the house. I'm at my office right now. So I think no. We're talking about most recently, Dan. We're talking about what
2010.
And then the immediate prior
2000.
One. 2010. So we're talking about, this came out of the Census Bureau. This wasn't just, this is a census statement. So we're talking about 30% of Hispanics in 2000 when they did their, I guess they did a comparison, the census did. And what they're saying is 30% of Hispanics in 2000, 30% of those Hispanics in 2000, when they did the census in 2010, said they were white.
Okay, they were specific people that changed. Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, this is interesting. So when people say that, oh, don't worry, the United States, it's still 60 or 65% white, that's not accurate.
Right.
That is not accurate. And this is why I never use, when people bring up census, I never use a census as reliable data as far as demographics. If you really want to get into reliable demographics, you have to really work hard and dig in and go into state records, and that's really hard because the census, there's some evidence right there. A Hispanic, I mean, what made them, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or not Protestant, probably Catholic if they're Hispanic, but I mean, this demographically, they changed from Hispanic to white, which is interesting. I'd sure like to know the psychology behind they're changing that designation. But let me give you an example. California, by the way, there's two states that they have declared are for sure majority Hispanic population, which California, I believe, has been majority for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But let me give you an example of what immigration, particularly illegal immigration, but I think legal immigration as well, has done just for Los Angeles, a city I used to really, really enjoy. 95% of all warrants for murder in Los Angeles County are for illegal aliens. 80% of the people on the most wanted list in Los Angeles County are illegal aliens. And by the way, a federal judge recently struck down a voter-approved law in Arizona that denied bail to illegal aliens because of the high propensity of illegal aliens to flee back to Mexico when they were charged with crimes. The federal judge said that was racial discrimination, and the fact that they were illegal alien was a completely separate matter, and that you could not consider the fact that they were illegal aliens and might flee back to Mexico when considering bail. Can you imagine the reasoning? And by the way, the federal judge was a Jew. We're talking about Los Angeles County.
Sure.
60% of all births in Los Angeles County are to illegal aliens from Mexico, and it's paid for by Medi-Cal, which is the Medicaid program.
Right.
35% of all inmates in California detention centers, that's both the county jail, the county jails that are run by the sheriffs and by the state, are Mexican nationals illegally in the country. There are 350,000 illegal aliens in Los Angeles County living in garages. Now, that's according to the census, by the way. FBI reports half of all gang members in Los Angeles are illegal aliens from south of the border, going as far as, say, Guatemala and Nicaragua. 60% of all occupants of HUD properties and HUD-subsidized properties are illegal aliens. 28 radio stations in the city of Los Angeles, operating in the city of Los Angeles, are Spanish-speaking, 100% Spanish-speaking, by the way. In Los Angeles County, 5 million people speak English, while 4.2 million speak Spanish only, and the population of Los Angeles is about 11 million. Los Angeles County's public policy is based on inverted logic, as a matter of fact, and they are a sanctuary city.
Mm-hmm. So, and there's a lot of sanctuary cities all over the country, which basically just says, come on here, we will protect you.
Yep.
And this is just appalling.
By the way, 30% of inmates in the federal system are illegal aliens. Well, that is just Los Angeles and Los Angeles County. Now, consider the fact that the state of California is majority Hispanic, and I'm not bashing all Hispanic. What I'm saying is demographics mean something, and third worldism means something.
Mm-hmm.
My position is when you open the doors, as the Jewish New York congressman did with the 1965 Immigration Act, and you decide to purposely take a first world nation and make it to a third world nation, you bring third world values and third worldism into the first world nation. These illegal aliens and these third worlders, they don't automatically become Americans simply by raising their hand and taking the citizenship test or oath. And most of them, as you know, aren't taking the citizenship oath. They are here illegally. They march on the streets of Los Angeles openly saying that they are illegal and that they are entitled to stay in the United States and receive benefits.
And who told them this? Who allowed them to believe this? Was it the U.S. government, the Jewish-backed U.S. government? Who was it that gave them this idea that they could just leave their own country, come north, and get freebies paid for by the American taxpayer?
Well, remember when Mitt Romney got into trouble? And but I'm talking about the bit where he was tape recorded by a bartender saying there was 47% of people that pay nothing, they're consumers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. He was right in that instance. Now, I think Romney would have been much more dangerous than Obama, because Obama is just basically a mental midget, and you see the effects of Obama. Obama's doing nothing. Obama wanted a second term. And while everybody's complaining that Obama is doing nothing, I think that is a good thing. Romney was a committed Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
Romney would have started a war with Iran. Romney would have given Israel everything they wanted. And so Romney was incredibly far more dangerous. But he was right on the 47%.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a country where you have, you know, all of these consumers – outnumbering the producers, it's not. It's the system is bound to fail, and it's just a matter of time. You can print all the money you want, and that's what Weimar did. By the way, they just printed more Reichsmark.
Mm-hmm.
We are living in a Weimar system.
Sure.
The reason why there's two reasons why we haven't been able to succeed in, I say, toppling it or replacing it. One, there has been no credible political alternative put before our people. That's our fault, and I'm going to talk about that as we go into the second hour. We have not, whether you want to call it white nationalism, ethno-nationalism, whatever, there has been no viable and credible political alternative that has been put before our people that will inspire our people to rally to. People will stick with the status quo as long as the proverbial train is running. And
sure.
I'm not meaning the train on the track. I'm talking about the system is running.
Sure.
Even if they hate that system, they hate that train, it could be running, it could be slow, it could be bumpy, it could be smelly or whatever. But as long as it's running, people will stick with it as opposed to something that they can't grapple. Well, that's just that one. I can't imagine that thing working. You know, they have to get their minds wrapped around it. There's a comment in the chat room that says, commit future genocide, some say, Rodney, due to decreasing white population. Well, that's been happening. Let's understand that back 100 years ago, we were about 28% of the world population. We're about 8% now. And women of childbearing age are about 6%.
Wow.
And that is mostly due to two things. It's not because somebody's walking around with guns and shooting us in the back of the head. Now, that is happening in Zimbabwe and in South Africa, but not, you know, on a rapid scale. It has to do with the tremendous birth rate in the third world and abortion, yes. Abortion has been directed and directed the cultural genocide as well that has been directed towards our people by the Jews. Yes, I named the Jews. And I'm sorry, Mr. Jared Taylor, Jews are not white. They're not us. And, that famous quote by Jared Taylor at Amran, where he basically said that they are us. They're not us. They've engaged in a cultural genocide that has led to that very issue that the commenter Anon 7239 is talking about. I don't necessarily buy into the genocide as much as I buy into self-termination, because that's what we've been doing. The genocide argument, people will not wrap their mind around. They just cannot wrap their mind around, because there's no death squads. People think of genocide, they think of death squads going around shooting people.
You don't need the death squad. All you need to do is buy into allopathic medicine.
Well, that's right, too. That's right, too. I mean, you can, you know, go to a hospital. And like I say, every time I go to the VA clinic, they're trying to push drugs off on me that I don't need. They even say they'll send them to me in the mail, and it's incredible. But I don't necessarily buy into the genocide argument, and that doesn't mean it's not happening. I don't buy into it as good propaganda, because I want to reach out to the white working class families who know that there's something wrong. They agree that there's too many third worlders here. They know that the world has changed fundamentally from the time they were children, which wasn't too long ago. From the time now, they know that dad is probably working two jobs and mom is probably working a job and a half, and they probably are having yard sales to get extra income, and they know that there's a reason for that, but they don't buy into the genocide argument, because it's just not something they can wrap their minds around. The cultural genocide argument is something we can get them to buy into, because they can see that. They can see that on TV. They can see how people are influenced, and that is something where I think we can win. We can win that argument. Now, as we get into the next hour, there's something else where I think we have failed in terms of propaganda. You don't win by running around screaming profanities and engaging in hypocrisy. National Socialist Germany, the National Socialists, they, contrary to a lot of people's perceptions, they were not a hardcore party when they were out campaigning on the streets. They were an ethno-nationalist party. They were Germans. In fact, in Hitler's second book, he said, "I'm a German nationalist." Mm-hmm. But how we win this, and this is what we're doing at ANA, is we do have a statement on ethno-nationalism, but we're not supremacists. We believe that the other ethnicities, they have a right to nationalism. In fact, we think that the blacks would do far better under the Marcus Garvey approach. We think that they have been culturally genocided as well as a result of the Jews' policies since 1945. And I believe that this is the case because they will tell you that. You can go on YouTube and just do a search on blacks talking about Jews, and you will find that a lot of blacks are very articulate on what the Jews have done to their communities. They will tell you that it was their banking policies, their economic policies, and their social policies that have destroyed the black community. If they get that, then pitching the idea of ethno-states for them and ethno-states for us won't be hard to get them to buy into. And I think that's a winning proposition. But where I think we win with the white working class, and to get them to come over to our side. And I think if ethno-nationalism is going to win, we need a huge transfusion of new blood, because those that have been in it for years with their bodies festooned with tattoos and piercings, with their profanity that is scaring everybody off, that ain't going to work. What I think we need, there's a comment there, yes, but blacks lump Jews with whites sometimes, but not all the time. That's a process that can easily be fixed. That's not a hard fix.
Right.
That is not a hard fix at all.
I agree with you that there are a lot of ethnic groups. Well, all ethnic groups have been victimized by the Jewish interests. I mean, they are the ones that really controlled the black power or the blacks in this country, with the control of the NAACP, which they controlled up until 1979. They are the ones that foment disagreement and dissent against with everybody else. They are the ones that are getting the Islams, the Muslims, and the Christians to be fighting, while they sit back and collect money and benefit from all this. They are the ones that foment all the dissent. And right now, the issues that people have with the illegal immigrants, well, the illegal immigrants are here because the Jews and their economic control and powers forced them here, compelled them here. And they did that to create some sort of civil disturbance, civil unrest, because you're going to have a lot of resentment.
Well, Jews are notorious, and let's understand, Jews have remarkable discipline and focus, and that's something that the proverbial white nationalist movement has never had,
right.
And that's their fault. But let me share something. Let me pull it up here. And, you know, there used to be this perception, or it was fact, that Jews, you know, had, you know, these secret, you know, they planned everything in, you know, in secret, and then they would go out and do. They don't even do this stuff in secret anymore. They had a conference. It was at UCLA. It was about it was a year ago. Here it is, right here. And now let me read this to you. This was out of the Los Angeles Jewish Journal, the Kasten Institute. And let me read you it was actually at USC, I'm sorry. This was on May 20th, 2012. It was at 4 p.m. It was a panel discussion. And this is called Beyond the Alliances, The Jewish Role in Reshaping the Racial Landscape of Southern California. This symposium will focus on the special role the Jews have played in reshaping the racial landscape of Southern California, from Jewish-Chinese relations in the 19th century to Jewish-Mexican relations in the 20th century, to the interactions of college students today, This will offer a unique perspective of the racial and ethnic makeup of Southern California as a result of Jewish activism, with a particular focus on the historic relationships in and around Los Angeles and Southern California. Now, this was a symposium that they held in 2012. I saved this article, you know, so I can show people that this is what they do. You know, they make these little alliances, they create the problem, and then they propose the solution. I'll post that. We are now over at ANN.com. We have a blog page, which our webmaster will put up, and we'll be posting that symposium. Now, getting back to the talking about proposing, you know, solutions, because one of the bigger problems that the what we call white nationalists, and, you know, I propose, you know, we don't call ourselves that. We're ethno-nationalists because, like I said, I believe that the blacks, I think after all these years, they've now had almost 6.5, they will have had 8 years with Obama, and they have done, what have they had to show for it? Nothing. I think that they would do far better under Marcus Garvey, and a Marcus Garvey type ethno-state, free of Jewish, you know, banking, free of Jewish social engineering, and let them engage in self-determination. And let us engage in self-determination. This is why I don't believe, Deanna, in gated communities, because the enemy can always lay siege to the gates. And in the United States of America, because of the 1968 Fair Housing Act, we're not allowed to have ethno-state-based gated communities. This is where the so-called Don Advo Amendment, I don't support that, because all that is that's basically apartheid, and we know that apartheid failed. And let me explain to you why I agree with Arthur Kemp. You can listen to my show with Arthur Kemp. It's on our page over at ana-ann.com. Yeah, I'm promoting our website. But
it's okay.
But anyway, the reason why is here was the problem with apartheid. Here was the problem with America. The founding fathers screwed up. Yes, they. I have some admiration for some of them, but they screwed up because they didn't address the slavery issue, because they thought they could have these blacks here as farm tools, and they thought they could have all the labor done by these non-whites, and that it would always be that way. They never thought that under their precious constitution, somebody would drive a Mack truck through this, you know, any sort of loophole in it or whatever. They never declared the United States an ethno state. They never addressed immigration in the Constitution. You know, they never designed the country of and for our people. And so as a result of, you know, having other peoples in your country, it's just a matter of time before you have what happened in South Africa and before you have what's happening in the United States. Let's understand that a lot of these what I call kosher conservative farmers in the Central Valley in California, who are now, you know, first of all, they go to church and they worship the Jews on Sunday because they're Zionist Christians, but they're screaming about immigration. They're screaming because they don't have Republicans getting elected in California, never will. It's their fault, because they hired and demanded to have all of these illegal Mexican farm workers who have 5 and 6 children and then become U.S. citizens, and then they vote liberal because they want all the free welfare benefits, et cetera, et cetera. It's their fault. This is why the concept of supremacism or apartheid, it doesn't work. It sounds good. It sounds good. You will hear these conservatives, you'll hear these Republicans that say, oh, well, you know, these Mexicans, they never vote. Well, if they never vote, then why are the Republicans are going to be in the wilderness and will never, you know, be elected to any statewide office in California ever again? Why is Jerry Brown going to be elected for a fourth term in California? Why is the why can California raise taxes at will? That's because of them. This type of supremacy, this ethno-supremacy attitude, instead of ethno-nationalism, instead of self-determination. You know, it was a foolish concept. And the way we win is through advocating for self-determination and admitting that this concept of the American experience has failed. It has absolutely failed. And the way we win is not through secession. That is a silly statement. The United States didn't allow anybody to secede years ago. I mean, let's look at the state, the federal ownership of lands in various states. They own a bunch of land in various states. They're not going to give that up. And why do people go around saying we want to, you know, we want to split California up into three or four different states? You have counties in Colorado that they want to, you know, secede from and form a new state. The answer is to secede from the United States, to break the United States up into ethno-states, and then you have the good type of trade relations like National Socialist Germany did. You give everybody their own self-determination, and we end. You know, people complain on these various blogs and forums about, you know, the various interracial crime, but they don't propose any solutions. The solution is a Soviet-style breakup, which was bloodless, and everybody went their own way. Belarus, the people of Belarus got Belarus. The Ukrainians got Ukraine. Now, of course, there's some, you know, that's being redrawn right now. The Kazakhs, which were never Russian, finally got self-determination. The you know, that was a perfect model. The same goes for Yugoslavia. You know, the Croats finally got self-determinations. The Slovaks finally got self-determination. That's Czechoslovakia was another one that was an artificial union.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that thinks the United States is a nation is kidding themselves. Anybody that thinks the United States is a real nation or a real country, now it's not even a country. It is a confederation held together at the point of a gun to serve the interests of the Jewish power elite. It's not serving the people here. It's not serving the people that actually pay the bills to service, you know, that provides the oil for the gears of government. It's not serving them at all. It is purely an artificial entity designed to serve the power elite. Why else do you think the United States has more aircraft carriers than the rest of the world combined?
Right. And more military bases and more of everything else.
165. 165
yeah. I think there are more. If you count
all of
the facilities.
That's what we know of.
Yeah, if you count all of the military facilities that the U.S. owns in throughout the world, I mean, we're up to like 600, and that's, you know, small military facilities or land that they control in other countries. I mean, it is amazing.
Where I was going with this too is another reason why we have we failed is, yes, ethno-nationalism is tied to race. To the race issue. Hispanics for Hispanics, blacks for blacks, Jews for Jews, and as far as I'm concerned, the Jews can go to Bir Abidjan. I have a better place. I have a better place, but I won't say it on the air. But
we know what you're thinking.
Yes, but that's what ethno-nationalism is, and that's what I am. I'm an ethno-nationalist. I believe in self-determination for all peoples.
Mm-hmm.
I believe everybody has a fundamental right to self-determination, to preserve their own culture, their own language, and to have their own nation states. I don't believe in these artificial confederations where everybody's forced together and forced to mix amongst themselves, and it creates friction. Go into even, I don't care what people say, walk into a cafeteria at a school, and you're not going to find the liberal multicultural dream that they think they will. You're just not. People do separate amongst themselves,
sure.
And there's nothing wrong. I don't find a problem with that at all. That's just the way. And you want to look at the biggest. You want to look at the biggest laboratory. Go look at the prison system. They really do. But I'm an ethno-nationalist. I believe in ethno-nationalism, and we believe in self-determination. For all, I believe that should be enshrined in the Constitution, and ANA does propose a constitutional amendment for self-determination. There's going to have to be a phased approach, and probably by November 15th, we are going to have, there's a page on our website called the American Nationalist League, in which we're going to have a comprehensive platform that lays out a phased approach to, you know, it talks about a platform for today, as we live, you know, issues that we can push for today in the current system, and a platform for an ethno state. I do believe at some point there will be a Soviet-style breakup because there's just no way the United States is not sustainable. And that sounds farcical. It sounds not, it sounds, you know, like it's a dream. But let me tell you how I think it'll happen. I think as the United States continues to erode, it's eroding like the old Byzantine Empire. The economy is not doing as well as people says that it is. I think that it will not be able to sustain the services that it has. We've already seen that it can't sustain those services. And when we talk about, you know, what I think will happen is the Republicans will capture the House and Senate. They will capture the White House. They will start farming stuff off to the states, which will be, in the end, will be good for us because that will be a decentralization from Washington. And you'll start seeing Washington being unable to enforce a lot of its edicts. You'll see fragmentation. Fragmentation is good. And as it continues to fragment, you'll start seeing people ignore the system. As this is happening, we need to get our and yes, I'm going to talk about economic program in just a little bit, John. I see John in the chat room, and he's talking about economics, and that's a big one. I haven't talked about that yet, and I said that I would. As we talk, as this American system fragments, that's where we have to have what I've talked about, a viable and credible and attractive political alternative that people will rally around. One of the big reasons why white nationalism has failed is because it has been singular focused, and it also has been unattractive. And what I've talked about, and I recently wrote an essay entitled "Draining the White Nationalism, Draining the Pond in Intellectualism Void of Ideology," and this goes to this recent, after I had my disagreement with Tom Sunic and opposed his, you know,
I'm still amazed by that.
Well, the videos are out there of him sitting there in the synagogue, and then, of course, I debated that Jewish blogger. But anyway, after I had that disagreement, and, of course, that was a real fundamental debate between me and, you know, Tom is definitely intellectual, and then, of course, I debated the Jewish blogger. But then you had this blow-up, what I call the typical battle of the blogs. You had what I call the Daily Stoner or Daily Stormer fighting with alternative right, and it was the hardcore versus the intellectual wing. And I'm sitting there watching this saying, you know what, you guys are both wrong. On one hand, you have the intellectual wing, which is like Mr. Taylor, and the alternative right, and the alternative right bashes everything National Socialist Germany. Instead of looking at what they did right, they had the ideal, the only ethno-state that was functional, that did everything right. They had an outstanding economic program, and the only reason why it never failed systemically, it was brought down by the combined might of Jewish capitalism and Jewish communism. And but this alternative right thing just cannot stand anything National Socialist. And instead of learning from the historical events, it has to trash them. And then I'll just give you my criticism of the intellectual side. We do need to have our own intelligentsia. I've always said that.
Mm-hmm. Every country should.
Yeah, but our movement needs to have that. My criticism with our intelligentsia is, one, they look down their nose at our white working class unless they want them. Yes. No usury, John, and our platform at ANA prohibits usury, and we call for it to be phased out now. But anyway, I'll get back to that. They look down their noses at our white working class families. They don't even make any attempt to reach out to them, and veterans, by the way. That is our focus at ANA, reaching out to white working class families, particularly families with children and veterans, for a whole lot of reasons. But anyway, our intellectual class, I'm talking about the people that go to Amren and they say, you know, Jews are white, and they invite mm-hmm. Jews to their conferences. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about this new right. I'm even talking about the recent, you know, the NPI, the guys that tried to go to Budapest with the Soviet, which I thought was kind of schizophrenic. But they don't have an ideology. And so that's confusing. First of all, you're going to tell our white working class, you're going to tell our white people that you know you want to represent that you know that they're basically not relevant, that they don't, and that one of these persons who has a one of these intellectual type websites says that they don't really count, they never lead anything, and they never, you know, they really don't determine anything. That was his words. And I really found that to be condescending and really historically incorrect, because it was the working class Germans that catapulted the NSDAP and made them the largest party.
Exactly.
And made Hitler to be able to be chancellor.
Right.
It was that it was the working class and the peasants on the left that enabled, that brought down the Tsar. Now, that was not a good thing, but I'm just saying,
sure,
the working class, the people that actually
but that was just a few. That was just a few. You know, it only took 200 communists.
Well, yeah,
to go
well,
in
it never,
there.
It never takes it. You don't need it. Never takes huge masses,
right,
to perfect change. It never does.
Right.
But anyway,
we do have another caller that I believe is actually a caller.
But anyway, what I was saying is my issue with the intellectuals is, they may write a lot of really wordy books, and I do believe we need it, but they lack ideology. They lack a plan that will unite and bring our, you know, bring solutions to our people. At the same time, they hold our white working class in disdain, and that they also send mixed signals. And let me finish this before we go to our caller, then I'll
sure
talk about the hardcore wing. If you have a conference and you're talking about, you know, preserving our culture, preserving our posterity, our race, our people, our children's future, and then you invite Jews to speak at that conference, that sends mixed signals. If you declare that Jews are white, that is hypocritical. Furthermore, if you and Richard Spencer of NPI did this, he had a speaker stand up in which he identified this speaker, introduced this speaker as the ideal example of male masculinity, and that specific person was a homosexual.
Oh my gosh.
This sends wrong signals to our people. Anyway, you want to take the caller, then I'll go on.
That would be really funny. All righty. We're going to take 830. 830.
Yeah. Mark. Pardon me?
830.
Yes.
You have a question? All righty. Go ahead.
Yes, I do. I would like to ask Mr. Martin to settle an open question by stating what college or university he graduated from. He recently said on a program that he graduated Phi Beta Kappa, and so it's kind of important to know what school he graduated from.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Rodney, are you there?
Yeah, I heard it. It was Carolyn. She can go on my Facebook page and see. It's all posted on my Facebook page, and it's on my bio.
Well,
at my,
please, Mr.
Website.
Martin, not everybody's on Facebook. I can't get onto your Facebook page. So why don't you just say it? It's a simple question.
It's
what
all
college?
There, Carol. What? It's all, it's,
what? Is it on your American Nationalist
yes,
Association?
It is.
Well,
yes,
I
know it,
is.
It isn't. No, it isn't on the American Nationalist website.
Is there a particular reason you're asking this question, ma'am?
I just said because he said on a recent program that he graduated Phi Beta Kappa, and it's Phi Beta Kappa comes from a university or a college. I mean, it's necessary to know if you want to understand what he's saying there, where he got that, what school he graduated from. So I don't understand why he keeps that so secret. I'm not trying, you know, I've been trying to find out the answer to this question for a long time.
Well, I've been trying to find out why you lived in Mexico, too, Carolyn,
well,
and you
don't
talk about that.
It has nothing to do with it. All right, come on.
Well,
I don't
this has nothing
go,
to do with we're talking
Facebook,
about politics.
So don't tell people to go to Facebook.
Well, my information
is nowhere
posted.
Else.
It's all posted on
Facebook,
my
Facebook
page,
is
and it's
private.
Well, it is it
no,
on
it's
ANA-ANN.com?
By the way, my Facebook page is not private. Carolyn, just because you don't understand something doesn't mean you, you know.
All right. Well, you have to be a member of Facebook to get a look at anything there.
Well, it's there, and it's on our the bio page on our website. It's all there.
Well, you must have just put it there because it wasn't there a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I don't want to
go on a goose chase, and you tell me that it's on the bio page and it's not there. So why don't you just say it? What is the big secret?
Oh.
Just say the words. I'll tell you where I graduated from if you want to know. It's no secret.
Why don't you tell us what you were doing living in Mexico?
Why do you not want to say where you graduated?
Why?
Because you didn't graduate, maybe?
Why do you...
Because you didn't get a Phi Beta Kappa, maybe?
Oh, you know better than that.
Did you get Phi Beta Kappa when you graduated? And from where?
What were you doing living in Mexico, Carolyn?
I was living there. I lived there for quite a long time. I was painting. I was enjoying myself.
Okay, well,
how about you?
I've never lived in Mexico.
No, how about you? How about the question I'm asking you?
I told you, go to my Facebook page, all my background.
Why
even
don't
a
he
complete,
say it?
Deanna, even
why
a complete,
won't he say it? Isn't that strange?
Even a complete timeline. Even a whole timeline of my life is sitting right there. That's why I think it's interesting.
Not.
Oh, yes, it is. This is why I think it's funny
when you
make yourself.
Why don't you just say the words? It's so
Ma'am, hurtful. did you have a question that you wanted to ask that's relevant
this
to
was my question.
Discussion?
All right, and I guess I got it answered. And I guess you're not going to demand that your guest answer a simple question when he makes himself a public figure and makes himself out to be a spokesman for Press TV and so on, and he won't answer a simple question like this about himself on your radio program. There's a whole lot to question there, wouldn't you say?
Well,
You know why? Because, Carolyn, you don't have any moral authority to ask anybody anything.
Right.
You're a liar. You're a liar and you're a fraud.
I want to thank you for your time.
You're a
liar and a fraud.
I hope
you won't allow Rodney to go on and on about me after I hang up, but I will say goodbye now. And I got my answer, so thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it very much.
All righty.
So
thank
long.
You. All righty. Let's get back to the discussion.
I don't, I made a policy never to respond to that particular individual because that particular individual has made personal attacks on members of my family. So I was not going to give that person the satisfaction. That particular person can go to the two sources that I gave and my entire life and career is posted publicly. This is why a lot of people laughed at some of her recent allegations, because they can go right to those various sources and see. The problem is, you know, if she doesn't want to do the research, then that's on her. But I'm not going to do her job for her.
Sure. I don't keep up with the squabbling and whatnot. I just tend to – I'm busy doing my thing, and I assume you're busy doing your thing, and – So, anyway.
Yeah.
All righty. Let's get back to the topic at hand. I didn't know that that was going to be an issue with the caller. I don't recognize phone numbers. Usually.
It's not an issue. It's just I made a policy that I would never respond to that particular person if she ever called in. The person's a fraud and doesn't have any moral authority to ask anything. So,
okay.
But anyway, where we're at is, and somebody asked a question earlier in the chat room about economics, and that is key. And we have about 35, 40 minutes left. One of the reasons why I believe there's been no effective, whether it's nationalism or ethno-nationalism, there hasn't been an effective response to what's been happening, particularly since 1965, is nationalist response has been singular focused. It's been fragmented. Somebody asked earlier, have was I advocating fragmentation? No. When I said ignore the system, that doesn't mean we fragment. No, no, no. What I say is we delegitimize the system by essentially letting it fragment and collapse, much like the old Byzantine Empire and the Western Roman Empire. But the NSDAP was not a singular issue party in its rise to power. As a matter of fact, it intertwined its ethno-nationalism with a very, very strong economic plan. And this is where I think we win. And let me explain this. This is why we also have to get our messaging and who we target properly. We have to understand that when I talk about the white working class, I believe, and I've said this on my shows and other shows, there are millions, I believe millions of white working class families, mothers and fathers with children, that they do understand that they're being displaced. They understand that they probably have lost good-paying jobs and are now being forced to work at Walmart or service industry jobs.
Or not at all.
They've given up jobs. And they understand that a third-world immigrant whether it is legal or illegal, is responsible for this. They also understand that multiculturalism that they've been, you know, pounded into their head at school and on TV and all that isn't going to feed their children, isn't going to give them a job, isn't going to, you know, stave off that foreclosure notice. So there has to be a proper message. And if it's going to be, you know, if ethno-nationalism is going to win, we have to intertwine economics, a strong message of positive third-way economics. When I say third-way economics, it isn't socialism of the left, communism, and it isn't hyper-capitalism of the right, because that's what's been used and it has smashed them. It's destroyed our white working class. It has to be third-way economics, when I say nationalism and populism combined with that ethno-nationalism, which means we have to tell them that it's not bad. They shouldn't be ashamed to advocate for economic policies and social policies for their people, i.e., we should be able to point out that there are set-aside programs for every group imaginable. They're called 8A, for instance. They're called affirmative action, for whatever. And but there's nothing for our people. And, in fact, they have paid for it. The NSDAP was successful. Their message was almost singular focused on economics.
Absolutely.
Job creation. Well, I shouldn't say that. They campaigned vigorously against the Treaty of Versailles and the fact that Germany had been wronged, but they were singularly focused on economics.
Right.
They intertwined their ethno-nationalism and economics. But that is how we win. We have to have a firm plan of economics that intertwines with our ethno-nationalism, and our message of ethno-nationalism has to be one of self-determination for all peoples, that is self-determination. Ethno-nationalism is good for us, it's good for the other peoples, and that this artificial multiculturalism and egalitarianism has been corrosive and destructive for them and their culture and for us and our culture.
Right.
And that's the way it has to be. The supremacy angle is bad propaganda. It doesn't work. It doesn't reach in to, you know, the white working class family that is more or less non-confrontational. And for someone to say, well, if they don't want to go with it, then fine, we won't go with it. Well, you know, we've been having meetings and phone booths for 50 years. And as a matter of fact, we've been on the decline. If you look at the status of nationalism in the last, 50 years, it was actually much bigger in, say, 1968, and it wasn't very big then.
No.
Now we've relegated ourselves to the internet, And so
it's almost become a dirty word to say nationalist, because
the term nationalism was made. They went to work on that in
the 1930s.
They've tried to turn nationalism as a result. I mean, keep in mind, there's a tremendous amount of deprogramming from 1945 on.
Sure.
And
in Germany.
I did an interview with Press TV last night, and the reporter asked me about the nationalist government in Kiev, and I corrected the reporter and said that vassal state in Kiev are not nationalist. They try to present themselves as nationalists, but they're really Western, internationalists that are trying to surrender Ukraine's natural resources to a power elite.
Right.
And so it's important to understand that a corruption of language. The Jews have engaged in corruption of language and have done so very effectively. They do these types of – they engage in these types of tactics where they'll either corrupt the language or they attack they attack the messenger like the caller just tried to do. And they do things like this all the time. And it doesn't we can either choose to continue to wallow and engage in like these battles of the blogs – or the podcast pissing contest, or we can move forward, and we have to understand that preaching to the choir isn't going to work. And that's what has happened. Let's understand what I mean about battle of the blogs and podcast pissing contests and preaching to the choir.
Sure.
Why I think these blogs and forums are doing us more of a disservice, particularly on the hardcore side, is they have – they keep our people sedentary. What's happened is a lot of people have decided that 1,000 people blogging 1,000 blog posts at Stormfront or VNN or whatever, that takes the place of real activism and going out and engaging people. It used to be we would go out and interact with people. We don't do that anymore.
Well, you do, and I know other people do. They go out. I mean, you have tried to build bridges and have tried to see people eyeball to eyeball, and I think that's really good.
Yeah, but there's not enough of it. There's not enough of it. What's happening is we have not put up any effective opposition to their agenda. Here is the problem. The Reds, just because there's 1,000 blog posts at Stormfront or 2,000 over here, that's us talking to ourselves, and that's a very small spectrum. Putting up a newspaper article, cut and paste, talking about the problem, that doesn't present a solution that will draw more people to us. What's happened is the Reds, we'll call them the Reds, the cultural Marxist, they've taken the streets. They've gone out and engaged people. They've grabbed more people sitting on the fence than we have. They have defined the agenda. They've defined the narrative. And what's most important and most destructive is they've defined nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have double work. We have to basically redefine nationalism as a positive rather than redefine nationalism as a positive rather than a negative. And then we also have to get our ideas out there. And we have been very, very anemic in terms of ideas. We've not put forth an economic plan. Any sort of alternative economics. We talk about, look what the Germans did in the 1930s. Well, yeah, some of the concepts of Germany in the 1930s are applicable, but it has to be reworked to fit today because there's a lot of differences between Germany in the 1930s and the world today. The population.
Hitler said that it wasn't to be exported. It fit the country for the time period, but that and the general principles can be applicable in other countries. But you actually have to have control of the economic system in the country in order to do that. And we don't have that because there is another entity that controls it. So how are you going to get around that?
John in the chat room says nationalism is falsely equated with fascism. Well, there's another issue. That's where, because we have ceased to engage with new people, we've allowed our opponents to basically define what fascism is, to define mm-hmm. what National Socialism is, and they've defined it all as a negative.
Well, they usually say that fascism is like communism, and that's not true.
Yeah,
or they say it's corporatism.
Or they define fascism and National Socialism as one and the same, and that is not the case. Or they define both of them as genocide, totalitarianism, and totalitarianism as a negative, and it's not necessarily a negative. So, the greatest impediment is the use of the internet as a primary tool for outreach, as opposed to using the internet to supplement and back up our ground game.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural Marxist, when the internet really came on the came online, they saw the internet as a great tool to back up their ground game. What we did was we basically pulled our ground game. We don't have a ground game anymore. There are still a few groups that try to have demonstrations, but they're few and far between because there's no participation. A demonstration that has four or five people, that's a negative.
Oh, absolutely.
That's not – because what happens is the average person that we're trying to reach out to looks at a demonstration of four or five people as opposed to 100 counter demonstrations. They say, my God, that's all the support they have. I can't rally to that.
Sure.
It's not going to work. And if you have a police line of, 50 police, holding off, it just doesn't work. We're in a conundrum because we surrendered the ground game. And that just doesn't that is something we're going to have to get back. How do we get that back? As long as we're fearful of advancing our goals and objectives, then we're not going to have a ground game. And
sure.
a ground game is more than leafleting. I dare say more people that goes to like town meetings and stands up for positions based on their interests, that will develop. But part of the problem is the desire for instant gratification, and that's another problem.
Sure.
The Marxists and our opponents, they are remarkably patient and methodical.
And very skilled debate, too.
Well, not only debate, but they're very skilled and they're patient. They understand that, they were in this wilderness that we're in, okay? They were in this political wilderness, and, starting in the 1960s, they started pouncing. They got the Civil Rights Act. They got the Voting Rights Act. They got the Equal Housing Act. They got the Immigration Act. And then, due to the immigration, they started winning locally. They started taking cities.
Sure.
They started taking counties. Now they're at this apex. They're sitting here, and they don't. They can either hold it, or they can either lose it, or there's going to be a split. Now, my hope is that there will be a split. Quite frankly, let the split is the Soviet-style collapse. That benefits us. For those that think, and I heard a comment the other day on another show, I don't want to give anything back that we work to build. Well, we're not going to get it all back. Does anybody really think that we're going to get Detroit back? Do we want it back? That is a statement, and that's a comment for those that really don't want to, either move or do anything productive. There are certain areas, because of demographics and because of the realities, that we are not going to get back. We're not going to get areas and whole regions of, say, California and Arizona and New Mexico back. We're just not going to get it back. There's just not enough production of white children to get it back. And so for someone to say, I'm going to stand and fight, well, first of all, you have to ask yourself, is that something you're really going to do, and what's your reasonable chances of success? No. And do we really want to have that type of stand and fight? I don't think people really understand, unless they've been in a real combat situation, what that's like to fight in a city, you know, in an urban setting. It's not fun. It's not pretty. And it doesn't work out well usually, particularly if you're outnumbered, and you have people that really don't follow the traditional rules of combat. So there's not going to be this proverbial race war that people talk about online in their midnight fantasies while they're drinking beer and eating nachos. What I think is going to happen is there's going to be a Soviet-style breakup. I think the cultural Marxists and the Reds have reached their peak. They've gotten what they're going to get, and I think that this 48-48 divide, and that's what I think it is. You have 48% of the people that like the way things are because they're consumers; they can get the freebies. You have another 48% that doesn't like it. And there's about 2%, and it could be a little less on each side. Maybe there's like 5% that just are sitting there. But what I think is going to happen is there's going to be some sort of split as the government is not able to sustain itself and not able to project its power. You're going to see it just gradually erode like the Byzantine Empire did, and like the Ottoman Empire did. You're going to see this flaking off of various
services. And of course, that
was
there was a lot of external pressure there, as well as internal pressure. That was very interesting too. I was just looking for this article about by Charlie Reese. And he wrote it back, and I'm not sure what date, but he said, really, there's 545 people responsible for all of the U.S. woes. And he said, there's 100 senators, 435 congressmen, one president, and 9 Supreme Court justices, 545 human beings out of millions who are directly, legally, morally, and individually responsible for the domestic problems that plague this country. And he goes on to say, it doesn't matter whether they call themselves Democrats or Republicans, they are getting exactly what they want. And they may say, oh, we've got to get rid of the deficit, and then people vote somebody else in. But we don't get any different. We don't get anything nothing changes. Absolutely nothing changes.
Well, I have a different take on it. I don't think it's those 545 people. I think it's the hundreds and thousands of people that put them there.
Okay.
Because here's the problem. Every election cycle, and we're hearing it now,
mm-hmm.
You have people go there. You have people, they turn on their boob tubes, their mm-hmm. rabbi boxes, mm-hmm. and you hear the Democrats and Republicans say, vote. This is the most important election of your lifetime.
Right.
Well, they just told them that 2 years ago, or they just told them that a year ago, or they just told them that 4 years ago.
And they
continue to vote for the same people or the same type of people. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result. They don't think, people, for example, if we were to say tomorrow that you only have, from now on, you will only be able to choose from 2 different styles of shoes, there would be a revolution.
Oh, sure.
But people are okay basically choosing from Democrats or Republicans. Have you ever wondered why people are comfortable enough, or, why don't they demand to have more political choices? They say, oh, no, we should only have Democrats or Republicans. I mean, why have they been conditioned to say it's okay to only choose between 2 factions of the same party? Let's look at this realistically. The Democrats and Republicans are the same when it comes to foreign policy. They both are pro-Jewish, pro-Israel. When push comes to shove, they're the same on taxes. They are the same. They both favor nationalizing your income. The income tax nationalizes your income. The very structure of the income tax tells you how much you get to keep. They've nationalized your income. I mean, the two parties are basically two factions of the same party. And I'll give you an example using the Iranian example. Under the Shah, he decided, because he was getting pressure from the United States in 1977, we better do something. People are getting restless. So he created a political system. He created one party and said, all the parties have to – everybody has to join this party, but you can have different, you know, ideas, but one party represents everything. It was mandatory to join that party. Even, you know, the communists, ex-communists had to join that party. The royalists had to join that party. And that was the idea. That's basically what you have in the United States. When you basically only can choose – now, they will say, oh, we have third parties, but – by virtue of the Democrats and Republicans controlling the political system, they pass laws that make it impossible for any third party to actually contest anything.
Right.
So, you know, the purpose of the American democracy, if you want to call it that, is to prevent change.
Right.
So you don't. So when people say it's the Congress's fault, they need to go look in the mirror. They need to demand real change. I dare say that if we had a real and viable nationalist and populist party on the ballot that can contest all 50 states on the same par as the Democrats and Republicans, they would be down in the low double digits. They'd be down to about 18 to 20%.
Sure. Well, the country was not set up as a two party system to begin with. There was no two parties until Hamilton.
Right. Well, keep in mind, the whole idea was of political parties was abhorrent to some of the founding fathers.
Sure.
George Washington just found them abhorrent. And there's a great quote from John Adams where he talked about if a political party started controlling the structure of government, the American system would fail. And so, you know, this is the problem. And I go back to having a viable nationalist opposition. We have not, as nationalists, presented a comprehensive political alternative. And, you know, what we do instead is, you know, we run around anytime we're, you know, trying to do anything, and we get sidetracked with superfluous issues. We're great at identifying the problem. The problem is, I think, our people know what the problem is. I don't think there's not a single white working class family that understands that black flash mobs are targeting white people. I think people understand that. So we harping about the crime issue. I think people understand the crime issue. I think people understand that certain areas of certain towns are no go zone for our people. We understand that.
Mm-hmm.
What I think where we have failed, and we have failed tremendously, is putting up a credible viable political alternative that, one, our people can wrap their minds around and say, you know what, that's realistic. We can see a path forward to success in that. We can see that is viable. We can see that happening. Let's give that a try. Let's step out and endorse that, and let's give it a shot. Now, the flip side, the other side, and let's talk about a little bit. We have about 10 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
About this, you know, why this hardcore wing is very bad. When we want to reach out and bring in new people and create a movement. Now, we always hear people refer to the movement. We don't have a movement.
No, we don't.
A movement says a movement means forward progress. A movement is something that is affecting public policy. A movement is something that is moving forward. We are not a movement. We are fragmented. We actually find it easier to fight each other, as demonstrated by the caller, than to fight the real enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Dr. Duke's credentials have been questioned and attacked as well. And we have a struggle. We have a struggle. And what we have going on right now is we have an idea. We know, like these millions of white working class people, we know that this system is bad. We know that it is corrupt. We know that it is against our people. I did a 10-minute message to the white working class, and I indicated that this system has just basically turned against our people. And that's on our website as well. But what we need to do is create this comprehensive, confederation or umbrella. You're always going to have various groups and organizations and whatever you want to call it, okay? And that's fine. But at some point, and we see this in other countries, they come together under I don't want to say umbrellas, but they come together and they unite to oppose the thing that they are against. We've not been able to do that. We've not been able decide that we oppose the Jewish decadent system more than we dislike the personalities within our own struggle. We've not been able to make that decision. And so that's why some of us, including our organization, ANA, we just stand apart from it. Mm-hmm. And, as I said earlier with this caller, I don't do the work of our opponents. I will not do the work of our opponents.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back before we wrap up the show, where I think we win is we have to intertwine our ethno-nationalism with two components, self-determination and economics.
Mm-hmm.
We also cannot engage in conduct that scares away, and I say this, scares away the very people that we need to transform our struggle into a movement.
Sure.
And that is, and this is where I disagree with the intellectuals. The intellectuals belittle the importance of the white working class. We need the white working class, particularly those with children, we need them to transform our struggle into a movement. And you're not going to do that by screaming profanities.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to do that by speaking profanity as a primary language.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to do that by focusing on a singular issue.
Mm-hmm.
So that is where I believe both the hardcore wing and the intellectual wing get it wrong. You're going to have to actually be broad and demonstrate that you have a credible ability to basically govern. Let's understand, that's what we're being asked to do. We're asking them to govern and create a new political system, and let me tell you, that is a heavy task. That is a heavy charge to ask our people. And think about it. I mean, just think about it for a minute from their perspective. They have children. They're looking at the current system, and think of going back to the train model. The train is rotten. It's bumpy. It smells. It's disgusting. It has all these bad passengers on it that may rob them and otherwise. But it's functioning. We haven't demonstrated that our train will even run at all. And that is what our mission is.
Right. Yeah. And I think that you are right. There are a lot of issues. I cover a lot of health issues because everybody has health issues. And I think that if they recognize, oh gosh, what's wrong? That system is kind of messed up. Then they're going to recognize that, hey, that is the very same system that the government is has jurisdiction over, with the FDA, the CDC, and all the rest. So I think that that we do have our preferences, our things that we cover better than we cover other things. I also think history. I think a sense of history, then you can see exactly where you were, where you're going. History, I've always said, is prologue. And if you know that what governments, what communists, what Jews do to whole civilizations in the past, then you can, you know what you're getting into. You know what's going to be coming here.
Well, absolutely. You know, absolutely. And I think, actually, you know, people are more aware of the Jewish question than we give them credit for.
I think you're
right. And, you know, and a final point I want to make, we have about, 5 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
This, I brought this up and had a great discussion with Arthur Kemp about this. Not all of our fellow white people are going to come our way. And I accept that, and that's fine. Zionist Christians, as far as I'm concerned, they can go live in Israel as far as I'm concerned. If they want to worship and be Jews, let them go be Jews. I have no use for them. I have no use for traitors, and let them go and live in Israel, and let them see how Christians are really treated by the chosen. And that's a big issue. That is a big issue, because there are, I don't think people fully understand that you know, to do and to effect change doesn't take a huge mass movement. You know, the National Socialist was never a huge political party. The American Revolution was not a huge mass movement. As a matter of fact, a vast majority of the population of the 13 colonies were actually identified as, you know, loyal to King George. But you know, we don't need to have a huge, you know, hundreds of millions of people. You'd be surprised. People will rally to a small and dedicated and above all disciplined organization, and people that are speaking the truth and actually have a credible plan and a credible alternative. For the most part, though, people would just sit and wait and see go with the winner as well. So, you know, I think that we have a huge task ahead. And, you know, I wrote an essay a couple of years ago called What White Nationalism Must Do to Break Out. And I encourage people to look at both the National Socialist model for a, you know, a historical model, and then look at the Mormon model. And I wasn't encouraging people to convert to Mormonism, but I was encouraging people to look at Mormons as a true national community, and how to build a national community within a current corrupt system, and use that model. And I would encourage people to look at that model as well. Mm-hmm. We can do this, but it is going to take discipline, and it's going to take the willingness to commit to change, and that's scary. And I think, you know, shaking off American individualism is another one that is going to be a big challenge as well. And then finally, how much more time do we have?
We have 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, exactly. If someone people are interested in that caller's question, they can go and look on my ANA site and on my Press TV clips. They'll also find my Phi Beta Kappa key pin on my lapel on some of those videos.
Okay. All righty. Well, I think that people – are you still there?
I am. I'm here.
Okay. I think that, that people – I mean, I don't know what people are impressed with. I think I like your message. I don't I'd never thought about where you went to school because I just think it's irrelevant.
Well, she did have a problem because somebody wrote a bio without my input and put it on Metapedia. She thought I did it and put that I had a PhD, which I've never claimed that. And, of course, I've never done any Metapedia work, don't have a Metapedia account, and I think even the people at Metapedia told her that, and that was changed. But I did not write that Metapedia entry. Somebody else did without even conferring with me. But, like I said, because of her personal attacks, I have determined never to answer any of her questions in order to do her work for her. She can go look it up herself. It's all there. It's all public.
All righty. Well, okay. Thank you so much for being on the program today. And that website is ana-ann.com. And your other website will be up soon. So thank you so much, Rodney.
All right. Well, thank you, ma'am.
All righty.
You have a good day.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you.
It starts with you and me.